Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justine Briley, your host for this, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion every week as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. And if you're not familiar with the show, you'd like to join the many thousands who download it as a podcast, then why not go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Lots to discover there, including, of course, links to this year's Unbelievable the Conference 2017. Every year, we just settle down in London for a day of hearing some of the leading Christian thinkers, apologists, and theologians from around the world. This year's theme, Why Christ? Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. Saturday, the 13th of May, and the early bird prices will be ending soon on Monday, the 13th of March. You need to get in before that date for the early bird cheaper ticket price, okay? So do go and check it out and see some of the great speakers who'll be joining me, John Lennox, Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Jeremiah J. Johnston, Tim Smith, Ruth Jackson, Sarah Foster, Jamie Cuttridge, and others, and it's going to be a great day. I'm looking forward to meeting, as I do every year when we put the conference on, many, many unbelievable listeners from both here in the UK and around the world. The place to get hold of tickets, premier.org.uk/whychrist. Well, on today's show, in a change to what I announced last week, I said we were going to have a Hindu-Christian discussion. We're leaving that till next week, actually. We've got a very exciting discussion today, a philosophical debate. We've done a couple of those in the last few weeks and got another interesting one for you today. Let me introduce our topic and our guests for today's show. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the show, we're asking, why is God hidden? And in fact, does the hiddenness of God provide evidence against God? You can't hear, see, or touch God in the way you can another person. And many atheists and skeptics ask the obvious question, well, if God exists, why doesn't he make his existence more explicit? Is it fair for my eternal salvation potentially to be at stake if there doesn't seem to be enough evidence for God? Justin Sheba joins the show again today. Justin is an atheist philosopher who runs the Real Atheology website and YouTube channel. He believes that the hiddenness of God is evidence against the existence of God. Justin joined us a few weeks ago for a great discussion with Randall Rouser about a book they've recently written together. Blake Gunter is a new guest to the show. He's a young Christian philosopher who's been working on a response to the problem of divine hiddenness, but also regularly sort of speaks and debates on a variety of other apologetic issues. He runs beliefmap.org. It's a novel apologetics tool to stimulate conversation. He's going to be telling us about that today. But primarily our subject under discussion today is the hiddenness of God, divine hiddenness, as it's sometimes called in sort of theology and philosophy. So welcome along to the program, both Blake and Justin.
Delighted to be back, Justin.
Hi guys, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you both. Thank you so much for joining me. Blake, we'll come to you first as a newcomer to the show, though I must confess, so many people have been in touch over the last couple of years saying, why haven't you had Blake Gunter on? And am I pronouncing your surname correctly as well, is my other question.
Oh, close. It's Gunter. It's Gunter. Italian.
I apologize. Gunter. No, I'll get it right from now on. But Blake, tell us a little bit about your background. Specifically, you know, a lot of people are saying you're really showing amazing things in terms of your ability to interact with atheists and so on. What's led you down this particular road?
There is an atheist who was speaking at the local university here in Texas, and during Q&A period, I interacted with him a bit, and someone in the audience is David Smalley, who I believe you've also had on the show recently. He runs the Dogma Debate Show. And anyways, so David invited me on his show to talk about evidence for God's existence, and I guess the conversation went a little more philosophical than they're used to. And a lot of the atheist listeners really appreciated that, but they wanted to pull in another person who specializes more in philosophy to engage with some of the arguments that I brought up. And incidentally, that was the first time I spoke with Justin Schieber as well, because Justin was the atheist philosopher that they pulled in to talk with me about those arguments. So anyways, Justin and I had a really good conversation. The listeners to the show liked it a lot, and Justin and I ended up having a formal debate on God's existence later down the road, and I've been back on that show a few times, and it's just kind of escalated more and more. Recently, I've had some debates with Matt Dillahunty, another Texan, and yeah, it's just been a whirlwind from there.
Well, as I say, your name keeps cropping up, and a lot of people seem to rate you very highly, Blake. So your reputation precedes you, I hope that doesn't put too much pressure on you for today's program. But
it's cool to hear.
I mean, you obviously enjoy the debate format, do you? You find that's quite a useful way of getting into the issues?
I think both of formats, conversational and debate, are really good. The nice thing about debates is you have more of a structure that allows you to really develop your point without being interrupted. So it's nice. It'll give people a taste into the discussion, and I think it leads a lot of people to look deeper into the topic. So I really appreciate that format. It's not the best way to come to conclusions all the time, but it'll introduce the ideas, and sometimes you can surprise people. They didn't expect the other side to actually have a strong position, and debates can help you take other positions more seriously.
So tell us about beliefmap.org. What is that, and what would people get out of it if they visited?
Oh man, yeah. So beliefmap.org is sort of my life project. The quickest way to describe it is sort of a pocket apologist. So it's designed to map all of the evidences and arguments and counterarguments and counterarguments that show up in debates on God's existence and Jesus's resurrection. And those counterarguments are all unfolding in a process when you need them. So they don't show up right at the beginning of the map. They show up as you get deeper and you actually need them. So you can use it in live conversations, or if you're someone who's interested in exploring these questions, it's a lot more friendly way to approach the questions. It feels less like reading articles or a book, and it's more feeling like having a conversation with a very well-read apologist. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of conversation directions in the map so far that unfold, and well over 1,000 academic citations so far that pop up in those hundreds of directions. So it's a life project, and it's probably my biggest passion right now.
It sounds completely fascinating, and I must confess I haven't properly looked at it yet, but the kind of thing that in a sense would save someone hundreds of hours potentially of looking up stuff for themselves when they're looking for a specific direction to take in a conversation. It's great. Well, thank you very much, Blake, for being on the program today. Great to have you on at last, and I'm sure it won't be the only appearance you make this year. I'm sure we can set some other discussions up in the course of time. Justin, welcome back to the program. It's not been that long since you were last on, of course, talking with Randall Rouser about your new book. And this particular topic, though, is this one that you've debated before, that you've looked into, divine hiddenness?
Well, actually, with the debate that Blake and I did down in Dallas a few years back, this argument did come up. And so we briefly had an exchange in that context, in a more formal context. And actually, just a few weeks ago, Blake and I were on a kind of YouTube show called Capturing Christianity, in which we discussed this. And I think we both did some prep work in preparation for it. And so I feel like this is really good timing. We're both really kind of we've been soaking in the literature for a while. And so I feel like it's a good Great. Time to have that back and forth again.
I mean, you're not just interested in the discussions and debates, but also in the way they're carried out. That was very much part of the project you did with Randall Rouser, an atheist and a Christian.
Absolutely.
Walk into a bar. I mean, it was funny that in a sense that program was juxtaposed the following week, a very good-natured program between you and Randall, with a somewhat bad-tempered program between the two guests I had on, David Marshall and Richard Carrier, talking about the historicity of Jesus. So it just goes to show.
So I've heard, yes.
It can go in different directions depending on who you've got on. But from what it sounds like, you seem to gel well in the same way you do with Randall, with Blake, that this is someone you feel you can take seriously and have a meaningful kind of conversation with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I would actually further provide endorsement for beliefmap.org. I think that it's an excellent resource for both theists and atheists to look at some of the contemporary discussion in the literature. And so I'm a huge fan of his website, and I'm excited to see where he goes with it.
Well, look, that's high praise from both sides in that sense. And I'm looking forward to getting into the conversation that we're going to be having today on divine hiddenness. Why is God hidden? Is it evidence against God that he doesn't make his existence more obvious, more explicit? And if you want to get in touch about today's show, then you're, of course, welcome to do it via the usual ways. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll be reading some of your thoughts towards the end of today's show. You can also send me a message via Facebook, via Twitter, @UnbelievableJB, to follow on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. You'll also find various links and stuff that I post up there on a regular basis. Today's program available, of course, from the website, where you can also comment underneath the program, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today we're asking, why is God hidden? This isn't a subject we've explicitly opened up on the program before, but it's kind of one of the most obvious questions you could ask, I suppose. Why doesn't God make his existence more explicit? If God wants people to believe in him, well, just show up and get people to believe in you. Why do we have to jump through so many kind of hoops, I suppose, to provide evidence for God in apologetics and that kind of thing? And is that whole thing evidence that there simply isn't a God behind it all? I don't know if I've just done your job for you there, Justin, but do you want to sort of lay out the argument against God, if you like, from divine hiddenness, and just kind of how you would express it and why you find it pretty compelling?
Sure. Yeah. So the argument from divine hiddenness, I mean, obviously, as you laid out, the intuition behind the argument goes back quite a while. But I would argue that the most substantive formulation of the argument is by a philosopher by the name of J.L. Schellenberg. And in 1993, he put out a book titled Divine Hiddenness and Human Reason. And he's since developed this argument, and it's spurred a whole swath of interesting papers and books on the issue. But today I'm going to be just kind of presenting a brief version of his latest articulation of the argument. And so the first premise of the argument is that if a perfectly loving God exists, then there exists a God who's always open to a personal relationship with any finite person. So the notion here is that we're taking perfect love, we're taking divine love, and we're just taking it as seriously as we can. God is supposed to be unsurpassably loving. Now, if premise one is true, then arguably it entails premise two, which is that if there exists a God who is always open to personal relationship with any finite person, then no finite person is ever non-resistantly in a state of non-belief in relation to the proposition that God exists. So essentially what is being said here is that if such a God exists, then no one is going to non-resistantly fail to believe in God. Then we can get to premise three, which is informed by one and two, that if a perfectly loving God exists, then no finite person is ever non-resistantly in a state of non-belief in relation to the proposition that God exists. This is essentially just saying if God exists, there would be no non-resistant non-believers. But premise four tells us that quite clearly there are persons who both do not believe and are also non-resistant to the idea.
And just define what you mean by non-resistant, because I think that's a phrase that obviously is important in this. And by that, I kind of assume you mean someone who would believe if there was the evidence to believe. They don't have ulterior motives for rejecting belief in God. Is that?
Yeah, they don't have any kind of they don't have this kind of general resistance attitude toward either relationship with God or toward belief in God. Right. So the idea here is that they're just open about it. They're open-minded. Mm. So presumably, many of the non-believers in the world that exist have such an attitude. Not all persons can be described as being, you know, I mean, sure, there are going to be some persons out there who just, you know, like a Christopher Hitchens, who really kind of detests the idea of this kind of, you know, divine overlord, right? But that's not a true description of all non-believers. And so that's the kind of, that's the evidence being put forward here, is the existence of this kind of reasonable, non-resistant non-belief. And so if you follow those premises, and if you agree with them, then it follows inescapably that therefore no perfectly loving God exists. And so that's the kind of summary of the argument. And I know there are a lot of objections, and Blake has a number of them that he finds compelling. And so I'm excited to discuss that.
Great. Well, you've really helpfully outlined a kind of systematic way of looking at the argument there. And I think what it does turn on is this idea that there are people who are open, perfectly open to the idea of God, yet still don't believe. And that is not consistent with the idea that God is loving and wants to have a relationship with anyone who is non-resistant to him. And I've met people who fit that category, who would tell me, at least, you know, I can't judge exactly what's going on, but from the best of what they say, if there is a God, I want to know about it. I want to be in relationship with that God, but I just haven't been able to believe for whatever reason.
All right, so Brierley endorses premise four. Excellent.
Well, I'm saying, I, on the face of it, I see people who tell me that is the way it is for them.
Sure.
So, you know. But okay, over to you then, Blake. We've had the argument outlined there. John Schellenberg, I've been told, is the person who's really done the major work on this as well. And I know that you've interacted with a lot of his material. So let's just give you space now to kind of lay out how you're going to be trying to handle this across the course of the program.
Yeah, sure. So like Justin said, this is an argument about God's perfect love. There are different versions of the hiddenness argument. So maybe this isn't the type of hiddenness argument that you'd endorse, you know, if you're an atheist listener. But for many, this is how they'd go about it. And like Justin said, yes, it's an argument that was put forward by Professor John Schellenberg at Mount St. Vincent University. And just to recap again, the argument says that a perfectly loving God would pretty much, by definition, according to Schellenberg, ensure that everyone is always able to be in a relationship with God just by trying, unless they're deceiving themselves. That's what would make them resistant. So if any person exists at any time who cannot enter into a relationship with God just by trying, then a perfectly loving God must not exist. And sure enough, he goes on to say some such persons do exist. There are people who don't believe God exists, and so they can't enter into a relationship with God just by trying. And so, conclusion, a perfectly loving God cannot exist. And I want to thank Justin Schieber so much for having this conversation with me, and especially I'm wanting to thank him because he's letting me run through a list here of 14 reasons for why God may allow non-belief, and he's doing this knowing he's probably not going to have time to respond to them all. So I did want to say thanks quickly here for that.
Sure thing.
And as Justin Schieber knows, I think that Schellenberg's argument is so bold that it's nearly impossible to defend. And it's in part because I think there are so many plausible possibilities for why God may allow non-belief. And these are possibilities that Justin would have to close off for Schellenberg's argument to work. So as we've been alluding to, I've done a big research project on this topic at beliefmap.org, and I arranged these 14 possibilities that I'm about to list into five major categories. So just running through them, here they are. Category one says this: some non-theists who are not resistant to belief in God are nevertheless resistant to relationship. And so if they became theists, they may even become enemies of God. And I've heard this from several members of the New Atheist community, and this is relevant because the reason God is allegedly motivated to ensure that everyone is a theist is to allow for a relationship. And that motivation just doesn't exist for God when it comes to non-theists who he knows would immediately reject relationship. Category number two goes like this. It says, for some non-believers, if they became theists in their current state, they would just form a perpetually improper relationship with God. And it could be an improper relationship where, for example, the human won't ever believe or trust that God is all good. So, for example, very plausibly, there are many people out there who will just never agree with God's views or decisions about homosexuality or hell or God's reasons for allowing death and suffering. Now, maybe God could deal with this person's aversion if the person was open to God's morally transforming them, but many people could and probably do exist who are not at all open to this kind of moral transformation. So that was number one, and here are examples number 2, 3, and 4 of improper relationships. Number two, a relationship where the human would instantly be or become jealous of God's power. So Christians who believe the Bible commonly say Satan falls into this category. Domesday published an entire paper on this possibility for humans. Or number three, a relationship where the human would consider himself authority in the way that the relationship is formed. Moser published a book that covers this at length. Or number four, a relationship where the human would lack right desire for God. So, for example, we can imagine a non-theist coming to belief in God, and now he is praising and praying to God and doing these relationship-like things selfishly, just for gifts. Maybe he's interested in a paradise afterlife. He wants heaven. Or he's doing it just for religious experiences. He could care less about God. He just wants his spiritual fix. Or the new theist is doing it just to escape punishment, right? So many atheists will testify that if they became theists right now, they would obey and worship God, but only because it would feel like there's a divine gun at their head. So yes, it's a relationship, but it's very improper. Mm-hmm. And again, this is all relevant because any improper relationship like these could be such that it's better for it to have never existed at all. And I'll add, the improper relationship doesn't even have to be perpetual for God to want to avoid it. If God knows it will be an improper relationship even for a decent amount of time, he may slowly orchestrate events in the non-theist's life to prepare her so that when she does enter into a relationship, it will instantly be a proper one. And just to remind about the structure of the argument here, Schellenberg would need to rule this all out as even being possible for his argument to work.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Category number three for hiddenness goes like this. Some non-theists, if they became theists, would instantly enter into proper relationship with God, but then abandon it later in life. And this is relevant because then the relationship plausibly holds no value to God, or even negative value. So God can know that a given relationship will either become permanently improper, or God can know that the person will permanently abandon the relationship altogether, and God can hate it. An objector might come back and say, well, God would prefer a short-lived relationship rather than none at all. But entering into a relationship with God and then permanently cutting off relationship later could be, to God, analogous to divorce. In fact, there are a couple reasons to think it is like divorce, both conceptually and biblically, if you accept the Bible. So God very plausibly may wish the relationship to have never existed because he knows it results in this everlasting divorce. Mm-hmm. So that's three categories of reasons so far for why God may allow some non-belief. Category number four for hiddenness goes like this. Plausibly, greater relationship goods ultimately obtain with some hiddenness towards non-believers, specifically more relationship numbers or quantity, or more relationship quality, okay? So let's think about numbers first. Let's take a hypothetical person who we somehow know would both enter and stay in proper relationship. So categories number one to three don't apply to her. I don't know that anyone like this exists, which again is why I think Schellenberg's argument's already impossible to defend, but let's pretend we've confirmed at least one exists. For all we know, God's ensuring that she becomes a theist so that she freely enters into a relationship could require or result in two or more persons not freely choosing to be in relationship with God. And the idea here is that the butterfly effect in conjunction with free will makes it impossible for us to tell. For all we know, this world has the best, or one of the best, distributions which result in the largest percentage of people freely entering into proper relationship with God. And that's just talking about relationship numbers. We'd also have to talk about and calculate for relationship quality. So let's simplify our calculation here and just consider, again, our one hypothetical person who we somehow know would enter into proper relationship and stay there. It could be that if God ensures she comes to both belief and relationship later, then God could do it in a more powerful way. So if God gives someone a powerful conversion testimony, they get to dwell on that and enjoy that for all of eternity, worshiping God all the more, as if it were like a great marriage proposal. You always get to enjoy
it. Yeah, I get the idea.
If God could give that gift by waiting for a relationship, let's say just for 1 minute, and if that's the case, then, you know, contra what Schellenberg would say, it's very plausible that God would wait 1 minute in order to get that good of a great proposal that you get to enjoy for eternity. Again, it's just an example. Another way of bringing more relationship quality for eternity is by allowing the person to seek for a while. So lots of psychology studies show that we more appreciate what we work for. And so again, this is for a finite cost of hiddenness. For a time, you get a relationship benefit for eternity. And this is probably true of C.S. Lewis's conversion, for example. And again, these are examples of how some hiddenness can buy you more relationship goods, which God, being all-loving, may prefer. And this is the final category, number five. And it doesn't limit itself to relationships. That's what makes it different from category four. So category number five for hiddenness goes like this. Greater goods total around the world could ultimately obtain with God's existence being unclear to some non-believers. And this is relevant because it's not implausible that God would freely choose to prioritize these goods. Hiddenness buys us, and here we're skimming like 10 or 20 peer-reviewed papers, more uncoerced moral choices. Okay, so some atheists, if they become overtly aware of God's presence, they would plausibly be faced with overwhelmingly coercive reason to obey God, and it would snuff out their free will, is the argument. They might be coercively concerned with fear of God's punishment or the appeal of reward from God or God's opinion of them if they're seeking divine approval or some conjunction of these things. Hiddenness also buys us goods like more justice. Henry and Wainwright published on this. And if I had more time, this might be my main point to camp out on. God is perfectly loving, but he's also perfectly just. And that confuses Schellenberg's argument, I think. Hiddenness can also buy us goods like more mercy. Domesday published on this, or more moral knowledge. Ray's published a bit on this. Or more seeking of God as the good. A lot of people have published on this. Or more cooperation and relationship among humans. Swinburne covers this quite a bit in his book. So for this fifth category, hiddenness can buy us a lot of goods that you may not notice at first. So just to summarize and read these categories off again. Category one said, plausibly some persons would just immediately reject relationships, so God has no reason to bring them to belief. Category number two said, plausibly some persons would just have a perpetually improper relationship that God doesn't want. Category number three said, plausibly some persons would just abandon relationship later in life. Category four said, plausibly greater goods of relationship that God wants may only obtain with some divine silence towards some non-believers. And category five said, plausibly with some divine silence towards some non-believers, God can obtain certain greater goods total that he desires. If it's plausible that God may allow even one of these non-theists I discussed to exist for even one moment, then Schellenberg's whole argument falls. And at least for me, the prospects of being able to conclusively show that none of these reasons are even plausible for even one person seems hopeless. So those are my thoughts, and I look forward to getting Justin's feedback.
Well, we will do that on the other side of a quick break. We're talking about the argument about divine hiddenness as an objection to God. Shouldn't God simply reveal himself to everyone who's willing to enter into a relationship with him? Well, we've just heard Blake Gunter explaining a whole raft of reasons why God may have reasons for not doing that. And Justin Sheba, our atheist guest, is going to be coming back with his response to this in just a moment's time. You're listening to the programme that dives deep every week here on Unbelievable, bringing you conversations between Christians and non-Christians. We'll be back in a moment's time. Martin Luther King described 11 o'clock on Sunday morning as the most segregated hour in Christian America. The same is still true today in the UK. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we explore the great divide between black and white churches and what can be done to unify them again. You'll also meet the wave of refugees seeking asylum and finding Christ, discover why modern archaeology is confirming the New Testament, and find out what tech pioneer Elon Musk has to say to today's church. All that plus much more. Why not ask for a free copy of our March magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week. Find us online and add your thoughts there as well to the latest show at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And of course, links there to various articles, features, videos and conference details for this year. Unbelievable Conference 2017 happening Saturday the 13th of May in central London. Yes, we're back again. And we've got some brilliant speakers and thinkers joining us. People like John Lennox are going to be with us for the day at the brewery in London. So find out about the conference, all the speakers, the seminars, and how you can get hold of the early bird ticket. Not too late to get hold of that still at present. So that's all available at premier.org.uk/whychrist. We're talking today about divine hiddenness. And again, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the show, I do encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. And you can also, of course, find us online from the website. You can find the social media as well. We've heard in the first section, really, one of our guests laying out, firstly, the problem of divine hiddenness. Justin Sheber is our atheist guest on the programme today, and he's explained why, as far as he sees, if there is an all-loving God, then that God should make people aware of his existence if they're open to being in a relationship with him, if they're non-resistant, as he says, and spell that out in a kind of the strictly philosophical argument for that. But the fact that people do exist who are non-resistant to God but yet don't believe suggests there is no all-powerful or loving God. And then we had a variety of reasons why God might have perfectly good reasons for not revealing himself towards people. For a variety of reasons. There were five different categories, in fact, that our Christian guest, Blake Giunter, gave. He's a young Christian philosopher. And again, there's going to be links to both of my guests and where you can explore this issue, which we've already gone into at quite a depth. You can do that more from the show page. But Justin Sheber, coming back to you then, as we start to unpack this defence that Blake's given there. I mean, a lot of it for me was reminiscent of the kinds of arguments that sometimes theologians and philosophers give against evil and why God would allow certain types of evil for character development. Sure. and soul making and that kind of thing. Equally, it had overtones of the discussion you had as well with Randall a few weeks ago on why would God allow religious diversity in the world. And again, Randall had similar reasons to some of the ones that Blake gave there for greater goods that can come from the fact we have to live with each other with our differences and everything. As Blake said, you won't be able to respond in detail to all of those many, many reasons he gave. But where do you want to start? And I'll give you a good chance to have a run at it.
Sure. I think a good place to start is to, you know, right at the beginning there, Blake made the correct observation that this argument is a bold argument. It's a deductive argument. And I think that that's right. But I think that its strength is in proportion to taking love seriously, to taking divine love seriously. The argument is bold as love, as perhaps Jimi Hendrix would say. So I think that this is one of the few places where you can find persons of all stripes, atheists and theists, taking this notion seriously and thinking about the implications of it. So, you know, as you just heard, Blake laid out a whole swath of potential objections to this argument, and perhaps a good place to start, one of the most intuitive objections, is that, you know, God allows persons to exist in a non-resistant state of non-belief. Because in his foreknowledge, God perhaps knows that upon entering or upon acquiring belief that these persons would form an improper relationship. So they would enter a relationship for the wrong reasons, for example, or you know, they would have a particularly ungrateful attitude toward God or something like that. There's a number of different ways in which this might come about. Now, what's interesting, though, is that I think that this kind of undermine, this is a kind of low view of the divine. For example, parents, when they form relationships with their children, or when children form relationships with their parents, oftentimes it is not under ideal circumstances. Oftentimes children only enter relationships because of something they can get out of that relationship, or perhaps they do it for another reason that's less than righteous, right? The point is that the parent, if perfectly loving, doesn't see that as a reason to withdraw completely from the child. Rather, this is a reason to, within the context of a relationship, so within the context of something that requires belief, to kind of shepherd the person toward a more mature understanding of what a proper relationship is. So this is, you know, all these different reasons. These are the genesis of divine relationships. But this could just be the first step in a complex and reciprocal relationship. Relationships are complex things. They're not always going to be, you know, flowers and candy. There are going to be tensions within a relationship. And so all of these things that Blake lays out are things that can be accommodated within a human divine relationship. And those tensions that Blake refers to as reasons that God would completely resist relationship or be out, withdraw from humans, those are actually reasons that make the relationships more valuable. The fact that there are relationships that include tensions and problem solving, that makes the relationship richer. So rather than being reasons for God to hide, these are reasons for God to rather show himself to persons, enter relationships, and have that deep, meaningful back and forth. These are two-way streets, and that's the most richest goods you can have. So that's what I would say for that.
So that specifically it comes back to the idea that people would enter relationships for the wrong reasons and have improper relationships and so on. God should be able to work even within that to bring about his purposes and so on. Did you want to respond to any of the other categories that Blake outlined?
Well, I think there are objections that go all throughout those, but I think it might be best to kind of camp out on a few of them to really get kind of in depth.
Yeah, okay.
With the knowledge that I'm not going to be able to address everything.
No, absolutely. Fair enough. Well, look, let's have the conversation then here, Blake. And yeah, I guess the point that Justin's making there is simply, couldn't God accommodate within a human divine relationship the outworking of, you know, some of these issues that, yes, there will be people who enter for improper motives and, you know, in terms of the relationship, but perfectly within God's power to see that whatever needs to happen to make it the right relationship happens within the context of them believing that he exists. So, how do you respond to that?
So I see two things that need to be responded to. First, he pointed out how, well, look, these sorts of tensions are normal in a relationship and it can result in a richer relationship over time. And secondly, he thinks that it's actually a lower view of the divine, because think about how a parent would respond. Regarding that first one, I think it might misunderstand what the category is talking about. The category was very specific to say that there may be non-believers who, if they entered into belief in God, might enter into a relationship, but it would be improper, and it would be perpetually improper. So it's not as if the individual would develop a richer relationship over time. They are such that they would continually resist relationship because there's nothing that God could do. For instance, I gave five examples of improper relationship. The first one was that, you know, the human might never ever believe or trust that God's all good. And I gave the example of, you know, someone who's just always going to be opposed to a God who says that homosexual sex is morally impermissible. And so this person, no matter how long they may be even friends with God, God will just never convince them that that's the right way to do things, or that that's something that they should like. They could be actually kind of disgusted with that view of God. So he's not their God. They might be friends with God. They might be in a relationship, but the person would never submit to God in the kind of proper relationship that God's seeking. And very quickly, the second objection was that this is a low view of the divine. So again, think about your parents. But two points. First, God need not be like a parent. It could be more like a marriage, and knowing that the relationship will be improper, for example, that someone's marrying you just for your money, could be a great reason to avoid such a marriage. So it doesn't need to be like a parental relationship. And if it were, you know, a biological parent relationship, think, and again, I don't accept that, but think of an adoptive parent instead and the biological parent. Focus now on the biological parent that hasn't met the child. Suppose that biological parent knows that if they entered into relationship with their biological son or daughter, that that biological son or daughter would be in very improper relationship with the biological parent. Again, maybe they would just want to be friends because the parent is rich. That's just an example. That could be a perfectly good reason to avoid relationship with your biological child, would be the argument.
Yeah. Justin?
Yeah, so he responds in a number of ways. So one of them being that, look, these, the objections are misunderstanding the argument, that really he's talking about persons who would enter and form perpetually improper relationships. So one of the reasons he gave here are that, you know, person wouldn't believe that God is good. Because if, you know, God has this particular, you know, potentially, perhaps God views homosexuality as wrong, and this person's moral intuitions are so opposed to that they could never really accept that. I mean, I find this, frankly, just impossible. It makes no sense to say that upon entering upon acquiring belief in God and entering relationship with God, that God could not, within that relationship, accommodate these things in such a way as to say, okay, well, look, well, first of all, if you don't believe that God is good, for some reason, we're now advocating a view of the divine that gives an improper understanding of what God is. And I don't know of any theist who would take seriously the notion that God would only reveal himself to persons as a morally deficient God. That seems just wrongheaded. Moreover, if we want to say something like, well, perhaps God has moral views that persons are uncomfortable with, persons are always going to be eventually immune to reason. So, for example, unless they're completely resistant, in which case this is a complete red herring and it's irrelevant to the argument. So, for example, if it's the case, and God knows it to be the case, that homosexuality is wrong, then what it would take for the person to understand that is that God would kind of shepherd them morally, would kind of connect the dots morally, right? So I currently believe that there's nothing wrong with homosexuality, but maybe I'm wrong about that. What would require me to change my mind would be for someone to connect the moral dots, to provide the reasons for that moral truth, and then I would be helpless but to accept it. Beliefs are not choices in that way. So God, within the context of relationship, would slowly reveal why homosexuality is wrong, if that were to be the case. And that's something that can happen within a relationship. And that kind of perpetual learning relationship makes that relationship all the more rich and rewarding for both the well-being of the individual involved and just the relationships having an intrinsic value on its own. So I just don't find this this even a possible. Mm. It seems to undermine the power and the resources of the divine.
Yeah. Okay. So, Blake, there's a bit of an impasse here, because I think Justin is just saying he just thinks if God's God, then God has the resources to make it happen, you know, make it work, to accommodate, as he says, the fact that people will be in different states of disposition towards, you know, his divine views and whatever. But he'll make it work, just as we do in our human relationships and so on. But for you, it sounds like it simply is possible that people would, there could feasibly be positions where people simply refuse to change even with God kind of doing his very best to win them over in that sense.
Yeah, so there's two responses. First, I don't know if it's as easy as Justin's implying for God to prove someone that he's all good. I mean, God could do all these sorts of good things for them, but that doesn't necessarily prove that God is morally perfect. The option might be for God just to force on a belief to them, but then there's an argument that that would violate free will. So if someone will never trust God, then the question is, aside from violating their free will, what could he possibly do to convince them that he's all good and that his command is perfectly good? Some of that is just going to require faith in God. There's not necessarily something he can reveal to change that. The other thing is, let's say he does convince somehow the new theist that he is all good. That doesn't necessarily change things. The new theist could say, okay, fine. God has somehow convinced me that homosexuality is morally wrong, and moral wrongness, to use a philosopher's word, supervenes on God's commands. But fine, then I don't care what's morally right or wrong in this case. I still strongly dislike any God who would command that homosexuals not be able to live in accordance with their feelings and to be able to have homosexual sex. Like, I don't care if it's right or wrong. I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And I don't like any God who would command along those lines.
And just to make clear, we're talking in sort of examples here, but is what you're saying, Blake, if there's just one person who is relationally open but has this barrier, then this undercuts Schellenberg's argument altogether. Is that what you're saying?
Right. What we need to find is an example. We only need one to undermine a key premise of the argument. An example where God would allow a non-believer in God, a non-theist, to remain a non-theist, even if the person was open to believing in God. And this is an example of such a person, is a person who would enter into an improper relationship if God revealed himself to them. And yes, some people are if God revealed his existence to that person, or more accurately, ensured that they came to belief in some way, that person would just never, they would believe that God exists, and they might even choose to be friends with God. They would be in a relationship, but it wouldn't be the right kind of creator-creation relationship.
And from your perspective, Justin, just so that I'm clear on this as well, do you have to, are you kind of under an obligation to merely show that there could be one person who doesn't suffer from any of Blake's objections, who still doesn't believe in God?
Correct.
And that would prove the argument? Would you need to show that every non-resistant believer who is open to being in a relationship doesn't fall under any of these categories?
So the argument argues that, look, that these non-resistant, non-believing persons, that it says that God would necessarily, it says that God would necessarily not allow even those persons to exist. So there would be no non-resistant non-believers. There would only be persons who whose failure to believe is a result of their resistance. So that's the claim of the argument. Now, I mean, if we go back to this notion of, you know, person still resistantly seeing God as morally imperfect, this to me is just a big red herring, because I'm sorry, I don't see theism as even coherent if it includes God giving a deficient revelation of himself. If the belief in the God that the person is thinking about is one that isn't morally perfect, then they're not actually believing in God. This is a story in which God apparently gives persons belief in him, but that is belief in a morally imperfect God. It just does not make sense. And again, to press the point here, this notion that God would be unable to connect the moral dots for persons is just impossible on theism. I'm sorry. Once you take theism seriously, that is something that will happen. Within the context of relationship, God will continually work toward that. Maybe, Maybe they never get to the point where the person agrees with God on every moral issue. That is so irrelevant. It couldn't be more irrelevant. The question is whether or not there is a continually developing and growing and valuable relationship going on. And that's what the argument is about.
I'll get another quick response from you now, Blake. But I did want to, if we get time, to open up some of those other areas you talk about, the possible greater goods that come out of God remaining hidden, at least for some time, from non-believers, and greater relational goods that may obtain as well, and so on. So, but yeah, briefly, do you want to come back on Justin's objection that at the end of the day, God should be capable of being able to sustain a meaningful relationship, even if we don't have final agreement between the new believer and God on all his moral decisions?
Yeah, so we're going through five categories of persons who God might hide from. One of them are persons who God knows would enter into a perpetually improper relationship. And Justin's coming back and saying, well, that seems incoherent. God would certainly be able to ensure that any person in a relationship will ultimately not be in an improper relationship. He can accommodate these things. And I asked a question. There were two responses I gave, but one of them was the question, well, how could God prove to someone that he's all good? Even if he revealed his existence, what could he do? No matter how many good things he does, the person just will always doubt God's moral goodness. And this could prevent the person from ever wanting to worship God. And I just don't know if it's coherent to talk about a divine revelation that would convince someone otherwise who's just not going to trust and have faith in God on the basis of other actions. Otherwise, tell me how he would do it. The person might just forever think lowly of God, and there's nothing God can do at that point aside from violating free will. The other response, which Justin didn't get to have time to respond to, maybe he wants to, or we can move on, was that even if God convinced them that this action, like homosexuality, this is just our example, there are multiples, but that's the example we're playing with. Even if God convinces them that it is morally wrong, the person could still hate the command and choose not to worship God, even if they agree that it's morally wrong. So that was where we sort of left
off. So we've
off.
Kind of restated really the positions there. It might make sense to move on, because obviously for you, Justin, you simply can't see why it wouldn't be within God's power to do that without necessarily violating free will, presumably. On one level, you could turn around and say, well, of course God can make someone agree with his moral commands simply by making them agree with his moral commands. But then that does raise the question of whether that person has consciously agreed, they've been won over to believing that, rather than it just sort of God's been a puppet master and made them think that. And for you, is the free will issue an important one, Justin, that this relationship is entered into in that sense freely, and their view of God is kind of taken, is not simply downloaded into their brain, but is kind of consciously accepted in a kind of free way?
I think largely the free will issue is irrelevant. So nothing about my response here is arguing that God would just force a belief on them. Rather, it's that God would connect the dots logically for them, such that it reveals things, right? So when I connect the dots logically for you about something, you can't like ignore this, right? You will accept it in the sense that you understand it intellectually, right? You might not like it, but that's irrelevant, right? So in this relationship, again, nothing requires about human-divine relationships that humans believe and accept every moral proposition that God has for them. The point is that if there's a continually growing and a continual understanding of deeper and deeper into the knowledge of God. That's what we're after, the knowledge of God, the intimate
But I'm sure there must be many people, Justin, you've tried to connect the dots for in a perfectly logical way, but who have still kind of turned around and said, no, I don't agree, I could imagine.
Yeah, but I'm not God, right?
Right, fair enough. Yes, but even I could imagine, in a sense, I suppose that person then, by definition, becomes resistant if they are being presented with, a case being made by God, and yet they still reject it. Is that what you're saying? That they would then no longer be fall within the terms of a non-resistant person, because they would have to accept the logic of God if they were presented with it and they were not resistant for some other reason to God. Is that
right?
Kind of
either they're resistant, or whatever they believe in isn't actually God. it's something different. It's perhaps something like more like Stephen Law's evil God hypothesis, yes, where they view God as having some, you know, abhorrent moral views or something, right? But yeah, I mean, this might be a good time to move on to some other arguments. That's, I think we've touched on that in an interesting way, at least.
Yeah, let's do that. Obviously, Blake's still of the opinion that for him, it's perfectly feasible to think that someone could continue to live in an improper relationship, forever with God, without them being convinced of his moral goodness and so on, necessarily. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment's time to start to wrap up today's show. It feels like we've only, you know, touched on one or two elements of this wide argument, and we'll see what we can manage in the last sort of segment of the program today. You're listening to a discussion on the hiddenness of God. We're tackling this at very much a philosophical level today with Justin Schieber. He's an atheist philosopher, runs the Real Atheology website and YouTube channel, and Blake Junter. He's a young Christian philosopher, and he's been working on not just this, but all manner of apologetics issues at his beliefmap.org website, and I do recommend you go there and check it out. But today, responding to the problem of divine hiddenness, and we'll hear from Blake again in a moment's time on the other side of a short break.
How can I know it's true? What about other religions?
Why Christ? Join me, Justin Brierley, to find answers at Unbelievable The Conference 2017. Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything, and how to share him with others. Plus, I'll be launching my new book and sharing why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. It's in London on Saturday the 13th of May with great speakers, including Professor John Lennox, Beth Grove, Andy Bannister, and Jeremiah J. Johnston of our conference partner, the Christian Thinkers Society. Early bird tickets are available now at premier.org.uk/whychrist.
Welcome back to today's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter every week as part of Faith Explored. Find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Loads of past shows, features, articles, videos and much more besides. This year's Unbelievable Conference 2017 on Saturday the 13th of May. Full details there from the website. John Lennox is joining us as one of the roster of speakers for the conference. But exciting. I've been sent details of another tour that he's involved in Ireland. It's the Reasons for Hope 2017 Island of Ireland tour, being put on by the Christian Unions in Ireland. And in fact, it's both Dr. William Lane Craig and Professor John Lennox who are going to be touring Cork, Dublin and Belfast for a number of debates and lectures with Q&A. Looks really exciting. So it's happening from Tuesday the 21st of March, kicks off with a debate with William Lane Craig debating Michael Nugent of Atheist Ireland in Cork, and finishes up around the beginning of April, Monday 3rd of April, with a lecture by John Lennox in Belfast, and a number of dates in between. So if you want more details about that, if you live in Ireland and you'd like to get along to any of those dates in Cork, Dublin and Belfast, facebook.com/reasons2017. That's the Reasons for Hope 2017 Ireland tour with John Lennox and William Lane Craig. Fantastic stuff. Hoping to get John Lennox on the programme, of course, in advance of this year's conference at some point. And a reminder that the early bird ticket offer ends on Monday the 13th of March for the Unbelievable Conference here in London. So do get along there if you can. premier.org.uk/whychrist. If you're a regular listener to Unbelievable, you'll also know that the magazine I edit, Premier Christianity Magazine, has a close relationship with this programme. The latest March edition is out. I was honoured to be able to write the cover story for this month's edition on the black and white church and whether we can reunite a segregated church, because both here in the UK and in the USA, we effectively have a black church and a white church. Examples of truly multicultural denominations and congregations are fairly few and far between. So I've sat down with some really interesting people to talk about that, and you can read about it in the latest edition of the magazine. If you want to get a free sample copy, premierchristianity.com/free sample, or go to the website there to read the article online as well. Later on, we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent shows. Next week, I'll be talking to Deepan Rajaguru and Ken Samples on Hinduism and Christianity. Ken's got a new book out called God Among Sages. And if you continue listening after today's programme, you can hear Sam Hales from Christianity Magazine speaking to Alicia Harris. She's a black Christian poet, theologian and activist. Fascinating interview. And good news for those who have long heard me mention on the Unbelievable podcast, the profile, because we've now made it available as a podcast as well. If you listen via iTunes or some other podcast software, you can get hold of it. So simply go to the webpage just to find out how to access and subscribe to the podcast of The Profile. And we will be adding loads of the great guests that we often speak to in the programme that follows Unbelievable to that as we go on. That's premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, in the final part of our discussion today on divine hiddenness, so we've been hearing from Justin Sheba and Blake Junter, both philosophers, one's an atheist, one's a Christian, and this question of why God doesn't simply reveal himself to everyone who would like to know and would willingly enter into a relationship with God if he simply revealed his existence to them. And this has led to all kinds of conversations, interesting back and forth across the course of the programme, why the argument that it shows that no perfectly loving God exists, given that there are people who are non-resistant but still don't believe. Well, Blake Junter, our Christian philosopher, has been saying, well, there are all kinds of reasons why God may not reveal himself to people because of the improper relationship that might develop, people entering into it for the wrong kinds of motives, believing in God because they feel like they've got a gun to their head, that kind of thing. And there were other categories as well, other ways in which Blake felt that there were all kinds of ways in which this argument fails. Justin Sheba, we've covered a lot of ground there in terms of that one about why non-believers who become believers might develop inappropriate relationships with God. But there were other categories, such as the third one that Blake said there, that some people might enter into a proper relationship but then abandon it later on. And then there was also these wider reasons for why God might not reveal himself to everyone, greater relational goods, better quality relationships. The search for God is part of the greater thing that person can then, you know, look back on in eternity. And even, you know, some of the good things that might emerge from the fact that God doesn't reveal himself to everyone in the world. Any you particularly happy to kind of to come back on in the last 10 minutes or so of today's show?
Sure. So one of the things that I thought was actually an interesting argument is the notion that, you know, God might hide from non-resistant persons as a way to kind of bring about a situation in which they might cooperatively work together, or, you know, learn about God, kind of find out for themselves that God exists, right? Mm. This is the kind of, you know, this kind of speaks to the notion, you know, the goods of us having this conversation right now, me and Blake on opposite sides of the metaphysical spectrum, you know, the goodness of that, right? So that seems like a plausible good here, but here's why this shouldn't be convincing. When it comes to the question of God's existence, when compared to the much deeper investigation of once God is understood and believed to exist, the investigation deeper and deeper into the knowledge of God, that is going to be proportionally much more of a greater good. So the good of discovery can be, again, accommodated within the context of relationship. So when we're talking about the goodness of discovery, that's not something that gives any reason for God to hide from non-resistant persons. Rather, it's a reason for God to reveal himself and then for those persons to embark upon the discovery of going deeper and deeper into the knowledge of God by knowledge of acquaintance, knowledge of experience, and deeper still.
Can I kind of interject with perhaps something just to ground it in an example, and it was one Blake mentioned earlier. Take, for instance, the story of C.S. Lewis. Now, I think he was in his 30s when he became a believer, and a little while later that becoming specifically a Christian theist. But of course, he was then able to use his story and his story of journeying to belief in a way that produced, you know, books and programs and radio series and so on, in ways that then helped many, many countless other believers, I would include myself, to appreciate their relationship with God or to come into a relationship with God. And I'm guessing that's one example where Blake would say God may have had good reasons for not immediately revealing himself to C.S. Lewis, but kind of holding back in some way and allowing Lewis to come to belief in God through the rational means he eventually did come to belief in God, rather than sort of just giving him immediate, obvious, because then his story, the nature of his conversion over a longer period of time has helped countless other people. So is that kind of helpful? Is that the kind of example where you know, Blake would say, well, there you've got a good example of a greater good coming out of the fact that God, at least for a period, hid himself from C.S. Lewis?
Right. We can understand that to be a good thing in the world that exists, right? Mm. In the actual world where there are persons who don't believe and who are not resistant, right? But that, of course, doesn't address the question of why in the first place they were non-resistantly in a state of non-belief about the existence of God, right? So that, to me, it doesn't make sense of the argument. With regard to his story being a kind of inspiration for others, that seems irrelevant in the sense that the persons to which this would be an inspiration, they're again either going to be resistant to the idea, or they're going to be open to it. And if they're open, they are going to believe if God exists. That is what perfect love would entail.
So we shouldn't need the example of C.S. Lewis's life to believe. God should just grant us belief.
Right. It makes sense if we beg the question that God did create this actual world.
Right. Do you want to come back on this, Blake? And we'll start to begin to round things up, if that's possible.
Yeah. So right here, Justin has brought us down to category number 5, where we're talking about greater, not necessarily relationship goods, but greater goods total. And I'll get into the good he's talking about in a response in a second. But Justin Schieber's response was that, well, as good as these things are, the goods of relationship are even better, and at least for the person. And there are multiple responses. One is to do what you just did, Justin Briley, is you just go back to category number 4 and say, okay, fine, well, then let's focus on the goods of relationship, both the quantity of relationships and the quality. And you mentioned the quality of relationship regarding C.S. Lewis. And from his conversion, you get more relationship goods total around the world that you get to enjoy for eternity. So C.S. Lewis certainly gets to enjoy it for eternity as a result of the way God did it. So that's a relationship good, and it would block off Justin Schieber's particular response that relationship goods are the best. But there are other ways. So just to recap, we're talking about category 5, and I mentioned multiple, and we, you know, Justin Schieber hasn't had a chance to respond to all, but this doesn't have to carry all the weight. This is just one good of multiple goods. One of them is that, yes, as a result of hiddenness, we get to have more cooperation in a relationship among humans. And so one person who argues along these lines is Domesday. And what Domesday says is one of the greatest goods that you could give to someone is to give them the opportunity to introduce someone else to God. And what that does is that creates an eternal relationship between you and the person that you introduce to God. Then you get to enjoy that relationship for eternity. It's a powerful relationship. It's a badge that you get to carry with you for all eternity, and this is a powerful good. Justin's response at that point as well, as good as that is, relationship is even better. And the final response for me at that point is, I don't think that's clear. Maybe it's better for the individual to be in relationship a little earlier, but I think that these are eternal goods, and relationship goods aren't the only goods.
Yeah. So it's just one example, as you say, Blake, of I'm sure a thousand ways you could envisage that God remaining hidden, at least for a time, may result in a greater good. One being that, you know, if God simply revealed himself to everyone who would be open to God's existence, we'd never have the opportunity to have a show like Unbelievable, where I try and persuade people to become Christians.
That's right.
You know, and just think how much the world would be missing out if there was no Unbelievable. But I kind of get the point there. Justin, does your kind of, well, relationship will always trump that? You know, is that always the comeback you'll have there? That it's inconceivable that whatever better goods might emerge from God remaining hidden, it'll still never be better than someone being in a relationship with God as soon as possible.
Oh, sure, because relationship with God is the greatest relationship good possible. I mean, that is what we are created for, right? We're told that on theism, at least one of the main reasons we're told, is a deeper knowledge of God. So, you know, we're talking about the kind of good of, you know, introducing a person to God, right? Well, why would we want to ignore the good of once in a relationship with God, cooperatively embarking on an investigation with your friend, you know, in this other scenario, to better understand God, to grow in your deeper understanding of God, both experientially and in other ways as well.
What if the better understanding of God is dependent on the struggle that took place to come to believe in God? I mean, it's conceivable that some ways of understanding God are only possible if there was a kind of a period of non-belief which kind of prepared you for having a better understanding in the long run.
Yeah, I guess I don't see that there is a possible good of the sort of which you described there, where it requires a period of where God has shut himself off from the person. I mean, how can we say that God perfectly loves this person if there are times at which God is actively hiding from this person, even though this person is open and perhaps seeking God? That seems to be completely direct contradiction to the notion that God is unsurpassably loving. How can he be loving if he's purposely hiding from a person?
It kind of very much reflects the problem of suffering. And I suspect that what Blake's going to come back with is the similar kinds of responses that come for that, why God might allow periods of suffering in people's lives, even as a loving God. But Blake, do you want to make an answer for yourself? And we will start to wrap it up then.
I think we've hit on the main points here. Just know that there are, you know, that I surveyed 14 different reasons. Right now, we're looking at the last category, category 5, and we're looking at reason number 14, that hiddenness can buy us is more cooperation and relationship among humans. This doesn't need to carry the full weight. I think that there are many goods that come into play that can outweigh the good of this individual person we're looking at being in relationship with God. Yes, God is all loving, but God has more properties than that. As I mentioned before, God is also all just. He has other properties that build into what God values. And it's interesting because some of these, you know, God can't have it both ways. God might have to choose between one or the other. On my view, what God is ultimately looking for in virtue of being all loving and all just is, for the all just side, God wants a world without any evil whatsoever. Okay. And in virtue of being all good, God wants free moral agents to be in relationship with him. And now you have a tension that God has to deal with. How do you get free moral agents and simultaneously a world without evil? And I think that that's where the gospel comes in, at least for Christianity, is that God has to provide a way to cover their wrongdoings already. If he's perfectly just, he needs to deal with that, but also provide a way for people to enter into moral perfection freely. And on Christianity, the way you do that is by submitting your will to God. You get to freely choose to be perfect, and God empowers you to do that. And that's how you can get a world without evil. All these people have lived in submission to God, and now God can get a heaven. So there, long story short, I think that there are several goods that come into play, and God's lovingness isn't the only thing you have to calculate for to make sense of it.
Okay. So, guys, I'm going to challenge you to both give you kind of your 30-second pitch summation of why you think the argument works and why you think the argument doesn't work. So starting with you, Justin Sheba.
Sure. So the divine hiddenness argument, again, is, I think, you know, as Blake noted, it's a bold argument, but I think it's bold for a reason. That is to say that God, the idea of God, is bold. The idea of God is such that if one changes from not believing to believing, it changes everything. It is a game changer. And because of that, because of the boldness of divine love and what it would seek, I think the argument is a powerful argument.
Okay, thank you. And 30-second pitch summation from you, Blake.
Yeah, first, I just want to thank Justin again for having this conversation. Justin and I are good buds. We really appreciate thinking about these things together. It's interesting. Like, Justin is one of my favorite atheists. For sometimes I'll come across sort of the new atheist type. And for these guys, they only hear about guys like Richard Dawkins or these other atheists. And I try to encourage these people, look away from Richard Dawkins and start paying more attention to guys like Justin, because Justin is getting into the peer-reviewed literature, and he will help you grow philosophically. So I encourage people to check out his stuff, because he does it right. My final response, I would just want to say again, I mean, Justin hasn't had a chance to respond to everything, but to summarize, just remember the categories, okay, so that you can explore these on your own. There's a lot published that you can read for free online. Category number one said that plausibly, some persons would just immediately reject relationship. So God has no reason to bring that type of person into belief. There's an example of a non-resistant non-believer who God would allow to remain in non-belief. Category number two said that plausibly some persons would just have a perpetually improper relationship that God doesn't want. That had five reasons inside of it. We spent some time on the first one, but someone who wants to get more into it can look at the other four and more depth on number one. Category number three said that plausibly some persons would just abandon relationship later in life. And for God, that can be like divorce, and it could be something that God would not start in the first place. Category number four said plausibly greater goods of relationship that God wants may only obtain with some divine silence toward non-believers. So if you're someone who says, look, relationship goods, that's all we need to really calculate for. That's the greatest thing. The other stuff doesn't even matter. Fine. Focus on category four. I don't agree with that. So I think category number five is very important. And that said that plausibly only with some divine silence towards some non-believers can God obtain certain greater goods total that he desires. And in the opening statement, I went through a few of these goods. But there's, again, so much more to read, so much
of
more
course.
To publish. This is a gigantic argument.
This is very much, as ever, scratching the surface. You can delve a lot deeper at beliefmap.org. You can, in fact, find all kinds of interesting pathways through all kinds of different philosophical and apologetic arguments there. That's run by Blake, who's been our Christian guest on the show today. Justin Sheba is also a great advocate for atheism, and so glad to be able to have had you on twice in relatively quick succession, Justin, since the beginning of the year. Real Atheology is the place to go for more from Justin Sheba. Find it on his website and YouTube channel. And thank you, gentlemen, both.
It's a podcast now, yes.
And a podcast, yes, indeed.
Yes.
It's all kinds of ways to interact with it. I'll make sure there are links from today's program to both my guests' websites and podcasts and so on. But for the moment, Justin and Blake, thank you for being with me on the program today.
Thanks for having me again, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, our discussion did overrun a bit today, so not that much time to squeeze in some of your feedback. But if you do want to feedback on this week's programme, do send me an email, as usual, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be delighted to hear from you. And don't forget, you can contact via the Facebook and Twitter accounts as well, @unbelievablejb, my Twitter handle, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to leave me your thoughts via the Facebook page. And thanks to those who've been in touch about the the moral argument. We debated that a couple of weeks ago. That was Corey Markham and John Cranman. And then last week we had that fascinating discussion on what happened to evolution at the Royal Society. Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute and Perry Marshall, author of Evolution 2.0, getting into that really fascinating stuff. Just quickly then, from Matthew Williams, in regards to the moral argument debate that took place between Corey and John, says, surprisingly, my favourite so far. Really felt like it was a game where I kept changing my opinion as to who was winning. I congratulate them both on presenting a unique defence of their positions. I was particularly impressed with the way John, the Christian, highlighted and presented contradictions for anyone who claims moral objectivity can come from a naturalistic universe. That being said, I think Corey did a fantastic job of representing his unique version of the Euthyphro dilemma, as well as highlighting what we actually observe regarding different moral values held by different cultures throughout different times. Although I was very impressed with John's response to the dilemma as well. Simply, it is irrational to speak of moral objectivity apart from a person. However, as a Christian, I see the exact same problem that Corey does. We presume objective moral values, even though our experiences seem to demonstrate they're learned and changed. But I think John hit the only answer that really makes sense, and that is we know these things intuitively, though we can't necessarily prove how. One thing I might add is that everyone seems to agree there is a certain thing as right or wrong. Moral standards and duties flow from authoritative sources in all our known experiences, and God would seem to be the best explanation for our senses of moral obligations and duties. Lots of other responses to that, but I'll leave that one there just because we are short of time. I'll try to bring some more next week. This one from Andy Walton, who's a friend of mine and a friend of the show as well, a Christian who has been on the program in the dim and distant past. But this to the debate on evolution, and it was looking at this conference that happened recently at the Royal Society in London, exploring new ways of looking at evolution and whether the neo-Darwinian approach is dead. And we had Perry Marshall and Stephen Meyer debating this, and Andy says, couldn't resist a cheeky bit of feedback to the latest show. Every time you cover intelligent design, I get incredibly frustrated as a Christian. ID people do not represent me. I'm not a scientist, but intelligent design isn't just a scientific claim. It's a claim about the kind of God and world we believe in. And it's on that basis I find it totally and utterly unconvincing. The problem is that it's given an open goal to Dawkins' disciples, who gleefully dismiss the Christians who believe and promote it. Don't just take my word for it, though. Here's David Bentley Hart, the Orthodox philosopher and theologian, who's a pretty conservative thinker. Here's what he says about ID. Intelligent design theory is a deeply problematic undertaking, and from a theological or a metaphysical perspective, it is a massive distraction. In the light of traditional theology, the argument from irreducible complexity looks irredeemably defective because it depends on the existence gaps where natural causality proves inadequate. But all the classical theological arguments regarding the order of the world assume just the opposite, that God's creative power can be seen in the rational coherence of nature as a perfect whole, that the universe was not simply the factitious product of a supreme intellect, but the unfolding of an omnipresent divine wisdom or logos. For Thomas Aquinas, God created the order of nature by infusing the things of the universe with the wonderful power of moving themselves towards determinate ends. He uses the analogy of a shipwright able to endow timbers with the power to develop into a ship without external intervention. According to the classical arguments, universal rational order, not just this or that particular instance of complexity, is what speaks of the divine mind. And Andy concludes saying, it's surely obvious to Christians how dangerous this theory is. Not only does it make us look anti-scientific, but even the God it claims to show is a small figure. Thank you for getting in touch, Andy. I mean, obviously, Stephen Meyer's voice as an ID representative wasn't the only one on that show. Perry Marshall criticized intelligent design from his perspective, though you may not have agreed with Perry's perspective either on that. And of course, we have had theistic evolutionists like key people like Dennis Alexander on the show in very recent weeks. But I appreciate, no, not everyone will agree with the, from Christian perspective, the intelligent design perspective. And that's why more often than not, we are getting Christians from different perspectives on those kinds of issues to engage on them. But thanks for getting in touch, and thank you for listening today to today's program. Sorry we haven't had much time for your feedback this week. We'll make more space next time. But for the moment, let me tell you what's coming up on the program next time. You're unbelievable. that rescheduled discussion between a Hindu and a Christian, Deepan Rajaguru and Ken Samples. We'll be looking at Krishna, a significant figure within Hinduism, Jesus, of course, the figure of Christianity. And why does Ken claim that Jesus is unique among all religious figures in history? Find out next week on the programme that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Coming up next, The Profile.